Okay, so welcome everybody, good afternoon. This is the second part of a compiler construction course, which is now given by me, not by Michael anymore. And now we're going to do semantic analysis of whatever we've got so far. So can anybody tell me what are the two parts that a compiler consists of? So I hope that in the beginning of the first section, we had a brief overview of the parts that a compiler consists of. And if you go to the very, very abstract level, you can say that a compiler consists of two parts. We've just done the first part, and now we're doing the second part. So has anybody an idea what they're called? Yes, excellent. So you've done the front end, which is the scanner and the parser, which gives you an abstract syntax tree. And now you have the abstract syntax tree. Now you've got to do something with it. And usually, so far, this is like about taking the input string, which is your program, apart, which is the front end, and now we're going to synthesize something new out of it. So we're putting something back together. So that's the front end and the back end. And this distinction is not completely clear-cut, because in order to put things back together, we need to gather some information about it, which, strictly speaking, isn't putting anything together. It's just collecting information, collecting stuff. But it's all... it's all under the umbrella of back end, and part of it is semantic analysis. I think the microphone is not working. Looking at it. Oh, it is. Well, okay.
Louder.
Really? Even louder, sorry. Okay, so so the semantic analysis is like one first step in order to be able to synthesize anything. So the semantic analysis will do something that goes beyond what the parser and the lexer do, because the lexer and the parser, they only ensure that the syntax is correct. But that doesn't mean necessarily that the program that we've parsed successfully makes sense in some way. So, for instance, some of these programs could be erroneous in the sense that, like, an identifier is not declared, and then the compiler has to report that as erroneous. And what is erroneous is usually defined by the language standard. There's certainly that an identifier variable is not declared is an error in most statically typed languages like Java and C, but in languages like really old Fortran, if you don't declare a variable and you use it the first time, it's just there, it's just like used, it's allocated. So not all the languages are the same. Of course, the syntax changes and the semantics is also different. So we just assume we have C because, well, everybody kind of will get in contact with C at some point, and it's a simple enough language to translate. Why do we need a semantic analysis? So, for instance, for C, we need to check that an identifier is known, and we need to know where they are defined. So in C, it's very important that you declare everything before you use it. And then afterwards, even if you have declared an identifier, you might still be using it in a way that the C standard says is type incorrect. So even if it's type correct, that doesn't mean your program doesn't crash or does actually do something sane. But it's just like a little bit of a guarantee that not everything is lost. So we have to do all these analyses up front. And semantic analyses also have other uses. For instance, program optimizations are always based on an analysis of the program. And optimizations... they're usually called optimizations, but that's really a misnomer, because a program will never be optimal. You can always improve a program, so we will just make it better, and that's called optimizations. We'll not really deal with optimizations except for the very last lecture, where I'll just give an example, because that's usually what we do in program optimization, a different lecture. And besides optimization, we could also warn about things that are not incorrect, but probably incorrect. So that is also used, especially in C, to warn users about correct, but as of now, believed to be rather broken design issues, something like operator precedence. So there's some bad design decisions that the AND operator binds tighter than the equality operator. So if you say this, you might wind up first logically ending A and C and then checking whether the result is equal to B rather than first checking that A is equal to B and then ending that with C. So this is considered quite broken. And the same thing if you have something like this, A equals B means it's an assignment, and if it's inside an if statement, then that's often considered to be a mistake by modern compilers, because although this will assign B to A and then check whether A is zero or not, it's often not the intended use of the programmer. Usually the programmer means to compare the two. And so these things are, well, use cases that you could warn about. Okay, so how does a semantic analysis work? Well, what we got is a syntax tree, so we have to work with that. And the semantic analysis annotates syntax tree with attributes. And so in this lecture, I will talk about attributes, and in particular, it's called attribute grammars, which means we equip or we augment grammars with attributes, and then we get parse trees that have attributes attached to them. So here we go, attribute grammars. So for most operations on the source code, except for like later program optimizations, we often will deal with a abstract syntax tree. So many computations of the semantic analysis, and even especially the code generation, they all have to consider and work on the abstract syntax tree. So that will be our starting point. And the idea is that we define computations, and these computations depend on the node in the abstract syntax tree that we're operating on. So a node type is usually the non-terminal. So if we have an expression, we'll have if we have a production, let's say an expression goes to expression plus another expression, then we'll have certain rules how to handle this production using attribute equations. And the attributes we're computing usually relate to the non-terminal. So every expression, the expression non-terminal, will have a certain set of attributes associated with it that we compute. So this computation is local. So what is a local computation? So local computation only accesses information from neighboring attributes or from neighboring nodes. So if we have like a syntax tree that is an expression and it has two other nodes that are expressions, then what we want is, or what we'll have, is we have a bunch of equations for this production, and they only talk about neighboring attributes, like they talk about attributes of this E, of this E, of the plus maybe, if there is anything interesting with the plus going on, and about this E here. So it's all local. For each production in the grammar, we have some local equations. And then we compute new information from some of these attributes. So the current node is always the node on the left-hand side. So here we have the production E goes to E plus another expression E. So this is supposed to be a plus. And so what we want to do is we want to give some equations that relate the attributes of this E and this E to this E, for instance. So it's all local equations. I'll give an example in a second. So first definition, we define an attribute grammar. So An attribute grammar is just a context-free grammar, so a set of productions and a set of attributes, one set for each non-terminal and terminal. So for instance, an expression non-terminal could have the attribute value. If we implement a pocket calculator and we immediately compute the result of what we type in, we could just like associate the value attribute with an expression non-terminal. And for instance, a terminal 7 will have the attribute value, and it's probably going to be 7, for instance. And we have local attribute equations that relate the different attributes. So if we have an expression, a production E goes to E plus E, then we might have a computation that says in the pocket calculator, if we directly implement it, we might just say, well, take the value of this E attribute and take the value of this E non-terminal node, add it and use that as the value for this attribute, this non-terminal. Okay, so in order to evaluate these attributes, these attribute equations that relate the different non-terminals and terminals eventually, we have to evaluate the equations, but we can only evaluate an equation if all the dependent attributes in those nodes that the equation mentions are already evaluated. So in the example of a pocket calculator, if you just type it in, then the value of an expression in the leaves has to be evaluated before we can define the value of the left-hand side non-terminal. So we have to visit the syntax tree in a certain sequence in order to be able to compute all the attributes. So, and this all rather abstract talk, I'll now make concrete with an example. So if you remember the Barycetti computation, Barycetti construction of the scanner, we had an attribute called empty, which you didn't call an attribute, but it is. So we have this abstract syntax tree that represents a regular expression. In this case, it is the regular expression A or B, star. So we have A here and B here, and these leaves are numbered. That doesn't matter. I've just copied the syntax tree because I needed one. So, and then we have star. So that's the node here. And then we have concatenation with the A, and then we have concatenated to it the regular expression A or B. So concatenated A, concatenated A or B. Okay, so how do we compute the empty attribute? Well, when is A or B empty? Does anybody recall? Yeah, and in this case, the leaves are letters, they're not epsilon, so empty is true or false? False. So this is false, this is false, and this already indicates an OR. So this will be false as well. So, and here A or B is false. Concatenation of something that is not empty and something that is not empty is probably not empty. What about here? What is the empty attribute here? That's true. So star is always true. And concatenation of something that's empty with something that's non-empty is non-empty. Okay? So we can do that automatically by pushing the button. Yay, was correct. Good. So what we've done here is computing the empty attribute. Not very exciting, but it shows the principle, and it's something peculiar because this empty attribute, and I get to this square parenthesis in a second, it's computed bottom up. So it's from bottom to top, so that's what we call a bottom up computation. Okay. So how do we implement this? Well, we attach this empty attribute to every node in the syntax tree. So if we think about non-terminals, we only had one non-terminal, which is the regular expression. Let's call that E for expression. And this non-terminal has the attribute empty. So, and then we can compute this attribute in a depth first traversal, depth first in contrast to breadth first, where you have a queue and you visit a tree in like level ordering. So depth first, the most normal thing you can do, namely you go, you descend into the tree and to the leaf, up to the leaf, you come back and you descend in the other leaves. So you visit all the leaves and you first go down as far as you can, depth first. So at each leaf, we can compute the value of the empty attribute without considering any other nodes. That's why we can start bottom up. And then the attribute of the inner nodes will only depend on the children of this inner node. And so this empty attribute is a synthetic attribute because it's synthesized from bottom up. And how can we compute it? Well, a synthesized attribute can always be computed in a pre or post order traversal. So depth first means we descend first, and pre order means we compute something before we descend. Actually, this is wrong. We just need a post order traversal, so I should fix that. So what we need is a post order traversal. So we first descend, compute our synthetic attribute, then we'll have the value, and then we compute the new attribute for the current node, and then we go back because then we've computed the attribute for the current node and we're done. So in general, an attribute is called synthetic if its value is always propagated upwards in the tree, so from the leaves to the root, and the orthogonal property is inherited if the attribute is always propagated from the tip of the tree to the leaves. Okay, so this is, yeah.
Does inherited then correspond to the tree order traversal?
Yes, so if you have an inherited attribute, you would need a pre-order traversal. You first compute something, you pass it to the children afterwards. Like you set the value on the children and then you enter the children. So the pre-order traversal kind of corresponds to the inherited. Note that an attribute could be inherited, like could at some points be the value could be passed down into the children, and at some point you might take it out again and pass it up the leaves, and it's neither inherited nor synthetic. You can define such an attribute system, but it's also it is always possible to just create separate attributes so that every attribute is just synthetic and or inherited, which usually makes the design a bit simpler. Okay, so we've already said that empty is synthetic, it only comes bottom up. So how can we define formally the evaluation of an attribute system, or an attribute system, how can we define one? So we want to compute the attribute locally, so for each production we want to give equations on how to compute the attribute. So we just specify so-called attribute equations for each node in the syntax tree, meaning each production. So in the abstract syntax tree, each node corresponds to a production in the grammar. So, and these equations should only depend on, well, they will only depend on the type of the node. So the type of the node means the production. So different production for, say, an expression will give you are associated with different attribute equations. So for example, for leaves, if we have a leaf of a regular expression and say the non-terminal is R, then we define empty of R is equal to, well, true if X is equal to epsilon. So let's say this is R, non-terminal goes to X, and actually we could have a second one with epsilon, but we'll just say that X can be epsilon here. So if the X is epsilon, then it's true. So this is the definition for the leaves, and then for the inner nodes, where we might have R goes to R or R, then we could say, well, we say the first R or the second R, so we add some numbers, and then we can just define a logical equation that says, well, compute the empty attribute, and this is the attribute of the first R in the grammar production rule. So this is a bit awkward. Here we, in the grammar, we just like have R's, the non-terminals, and suddenly we have to enumerate them. So in order to avoid that, we'll do a trick. We use a different annotation. Okay, so this is still for the empty attribute, which is synthetic. So what I've shown you on the last slide were some equations. That works very well, that kind of looked at every production in turn. And this is called structural induction. This works very well for attributes that are synthetic, but in general it doesn't work. If you pass something down, you cannot just write an equation that says, well, the right-hand side is computed by recursing into the different non-terminals of the right-hand side. So in general, an attribute equation can combine information from the children, like empty, but also from parents, which empty does not do. So these are inherited attributes. So what we want is a more flexible way to specify attribute equations than just by doing structural induction over the right-hand side, or over the grammar rules, say. So what we do is we use consecutive indices, and each index corresponds to the child, and the zero corresponds to the current node, so to the left-hand side of a production. So if we have the production E goes to E plus E, then empty of zero corresponds to this, the empty attribute of this E node, the left-hand side. Then empty of one corresponds to this E. Empty of two does not exist, because that would correspond to the plus sign. And then empty of three would correspond to this, to the empty attribute of the third E, of this E here. So for instance, empty of zero, so empty of the left-hand side, non-terminal R in the last slide, is equal to this equation if the X is epsilon is true, otherwise it's false. For the production R goes to R or R, then the first R on the left-hand side, this first R is empty of one, the second R is empty of two, and the left-hand side R is empty of zero. Okay, so you can see the pattern. You can translate the structural induction very easily to this attribute equation system. Zero for the root, and one to n for the n children of the right-hand side in the grammar. Okay, and sometimes you see that you don't even though your children, so here you have the production R goes to R star, even though the production contains an empty attribute, namely empty of one for the first R, you don't need it always. And so sometimes an attribute equation might, like an attribute equation system might be evaluable without even descending into some subtree. So it's not necessarily trivial to evaluate an attribute equation system, and we'll discuss that now. Are there any questions? This is the indexing scheme. Are there any questions to that? Is that clear? Okay, so what is the difficulty, what can be the difficulty in evaluating an attribute equation system? Well, all these local attribute equations where we can see what depends on which other attributes, they need to be evaluated using some sort of global algorithm, so something that walks the whole tree and that knows about the interdependencies about the algorithms. About the equations, because some attributes are passed down, the inherited ones, and the information flows up for the synthesized ones. So in order to construct this visitor algorithm, we need two pieces of information. First, we need to define some sort of sequence in which we visit the nodes in the tree. So this comes back to the pre-order and post-order. Once we enter a node, like from above, we have to decide which child to visit first and which child then to visit, and so on. And secondly, Once we know in which sequence we visit the children, we need to know in which order we have to evaluate the local equation system of that node. So for instance, for empty, we first have to know that we have to descend first into the children, and then afterwards we know that, well, it's very easy because once we visited the children have the attribute empty, and then we combine that information and set the root to the result. So this is called an evaluation strategy, and if it is computable, then we say it's compatible with the dependencies between the attributes. So I'll now discuss how to create an evaluation strategy, or at least how to compute the dependencies. So in order to illustrate what the dependencies are between the different attributes, I'll use arrows or edges. So an edge from one attribute to another one means that the information from the originating attribute flows to the one where the arrow is pointing to. So in the case for empty, it's a synthetic attribute. All the information comes from the bottom, from the leaves. So the arrows go upwards in both cases. And so the if we have an equation like empty 0 is equal to, I apologize for my writing, but the pen does not write where I'm pointing it, so it's a bit difficult. Or empty 3. I hope you can read that. So empty 0 is equal to empty 1 or empty 3. So if we look at this equation, then the information flow, the arrows point in the direction to where I'm pushing the information to. So it's pointed to the left. If this is a C-like program statement that computes empty 0 in terms of empty 1 and empty 3. Okay. So in the examples, I might have used empty 2 normally this is a non-terminal symbol and also a node in the syntax tree, and then should really be 3. Okay, some observations. As I've already hinted at, so if we, in order to infer some sort of evaluation strategy, like a sequence in which we can actually evaluate the attributes, it's not enough to just look at the local attribute equations and the local dependencies, because we also need to know which children to visit and which child to visit first. So we also need to look at these global dependencies between the nodes. So we need to ask, well, given some sort of expression, for instance, how does the information flow to the sub-expressions, and what kind of information flow can be at the sub-expressions? And since all these grammar rules can be recursive, they like the E production, like the E non-terminal on the left-hand side might be in productions that also use E on the right-hand side, and then you might have a lot of combinations that you, in the way that you can build syntax trees, usually infinite many combinations. So for empty, this was all very easy, because if information always flows from the children to the parent, we can do this post-order traversal, but in general, the variable dependencies can be much more complicated. So we now look at an example where we compute empty, first, and next of a regular expression. So the regular expression grammar stays the same. But I'll just show you the attribute equations and little pictures with the flow of the information, with the dependencies. So first of all, we have a start symbol that goes to E, the regular expressions. And here we have the following attributes. We want to know at the start symbol what empty is, what first is, and what next is. And so we define empty of 0, empty of the start symbol, to be the empty of the expression on the right-hand side. Similarly for first, next, however, is the symbol that is following, or the set of possible terminals that is following this regular expression. And we set that to the empty set. So can anybody guess what kind of attribute next is? thinking about going up, going down, bottom up, top down. So is the information propagated from the root to the leaves, or from the leaves to the root? Yes, and how did we call that? The two kinds of attributes we had?
Inherited,
yeah. So this is next is inherited, because it's passed from the root to the leaves, and first and empty are synthetic, because they're computed from the leaves to the root. Okay, so if we have a terminal, if a regular expression goes to a terminal x, then empty is true if x is an epsilon, and first is true of E if first is not true or false. First is a set of terminals, so it contains x if x is not epsilon. So it's the first letter that a regular expression can start with. So it's x for leaf x. It is x for epsilon. It's the empty set. So, and there's no equation for next, because it's top-down, we don't need to deal with the information that's in next. Okay, so in order to depict the information flow, we create little graphs. So we enumerate all the all the productions from 1 to n, and then we call di the dependency graph for the production I. So this is the first production. Where's my pen? Oh, dear. So this is the first production, this is the second production. So the dependency graph, the first dependency graph for the first production is as follows. We have a dependency from the empty attribute of E to the empty attribute of S, and similarly for first, because the information for first flows to S and for empty as well. And we set this node to a constant, so there are no dependencies. We can always evaluate next. Next one, in fact. Similarly here, first and the empty attribute, they're computed based on the value in here, so there's no dependencies on other attributes. So our dependency graph has no edges, just these nodes. Okay, so let's look at the grammar rule. The third grammar rule, which is one regular expression or the other regular expression. So the empty attribute, the regular expression E here, is empty if either the first is empty or the third. So this should be the third node. This is the second node. It's the first node. So if empty 3 is true or if empty 1 is true, then this node is empty, and the first set is the join of these two, and the next set is passed down. So next of 1, which is this one, this here is next 1, is set to next of 0, and also next 2 or 3. So we haven't been very consistent whether we skip terminals like or in the past, so this is that's why it's inconsistent. I'm not really fussed whether you count them, just as long as you do it consistently. I'll just try to count them now. Okay, so next 3, the third next attribute, is also set to next 0. So you can see that the graph here says that the information flows upwards for the first and the empty attribute, and it flows downwards for the next attribute. Same thing for the concatenation, it's just that the equations are a little bit more complicated. So for instance, here the empty is still the same, it's just an AND, it's very simple structurally. Okay, so what's the first set of E? Well, the first letter is of this regular expression that is a concatenation is the first letter of the left-hand side, so it's first of 1, which is this E down here, so this attribute. However, if one is empty, so we look at the empty attribute of the first child, if it is empty, then we also have to join the set first two into it. Because if the left-hand side is empty, then the first set of the sole expression contains the first symbols of the second E. So if this is something star, then we have to add those non-terminals or symbols. So you can see, so this is this question mark is a C operator for if statements, the functional if statement. So if this is true, take the first expression, otherwise take the second expression, which is the empty set here. Similarly, next of one, so next of this symbol here, the first E, what is the next symbol? Well, it is the first element of the second E, this set, joined with if the second E is empty, then we also need to look at what comes after this whole expression, which is contained in the next attribute, which comes from the top. So we have a flow of information that the next attribute, the next one attribute, depends on first two, which is this one. So you have to read it like this. This is one attribute, and it's one non-terminal and its attribute, and this is another non-terminal and its attribute. So this is first two, and it flows into next one, and also next zero flows into next one, and also empty will flow into next one. Empty two will flow into next one. So even though sometimes, so this is obviously the dependency graph is an over approximation, because if empty two, if this attribute here says it is non-empty, then we will never actually evaluate next of zero. So we never need this value here. But we just look at all possibilities, and that's our over-approximated dependency graph. You might actually define certain attributes here in a different way, and then you might come up with an attribute system that equation system that's actually not evaluable. I'm not going to give an example because I don't have it in my head and I might just get it wrong. Okay, so the other two rules quickly. The star, we say empty of the root, index 0 is true. First of the root, index 0 is the first set of E1. So whatever it starts with this E starts with whatever this E starts with. So can anybody tell me an alternative equation here? Like, I could say this is incorrect. Why? So I'm defining the first set of this left-hand side E to be the first set of the right-hand side E. Well, what happens if E is empty? The right-hand side E, if it's empty? There's no real answer. So we could say, well, it's wrong, because like if the right-hand side E, if first of one is empty, then I should also consider next, the set of symbols that can follow E, the set of symbols that we get passed down, which is in here. So we could say first of zero is first of one combined, joined with, and now the C expression, if this E on the right hand side is empty, so if empty 2 is true, empty 1 is true, then we also add the next set of our current symbol. Otherwise, we add the empty set. So this is very similar to the, like, analogous to the previous equations. But in fact, this will probably give us something that is circular, and the equation that as they are here, they're correct. So this will always give you the right result. If you look at the whole equation system, you might see why, and you might see why this is not a good idea.
Why don't you just write empty one question mark next zero colon first one?
Well, no. So because first is the over approximation of all possible symbols that the expression can start with. So it always has to include first one. So this is just adding symbols that follow here if this is empty, but we always need all the symbols that this expression can start with in every case. Not
even if it's empty.
Yeah, but empty is only an approximation. Empty also says it may be empty.
Maybe.
It doesn't. It's not necessarily empty. Okay, so this equation I've written down here is unnecessarily complicated. This one is correct. And this one gives a completely different dependency tree, and it could be a circular one. Okay, so the last definition here. Okay, so here you see next one. We should do that. The set of next symbols is the set of first symbols joined with the next of the root node. So the next of the root node flows down here, but also the first set flows into the next attribute. Okay, so this is all what you've done like weeks ago, the equations at least, but now the dependencies here are the important ones. So the question is this equation system evaluable, or is there a case when we cannot evaluate it? Okay, so first of all, so let's think of some sort of grammar that we have, say for regular expression, and let's assume it doesn't have any useless productions. So all productions are reachable. Somehow are mentioned, like all the left-hand side symbols of a production are mentioned somewhere on the right-hand side, and there's no, you cannot omit any rules, because otherwise this algorithm, this checker for whether I can evaluate an equation system doesn't make sense, because it just like gives would consider dead productions. So let's assume that there is some sort of set T that represents all the possible syntax trees we can derive from our grammar. This is, for all interesting grammars, always infinite, an infinite number of trees. So it's infinite as soon as we have some production where we have some non-terminal, say E, on the left-hand side, and that non-terminal occurs on the right-hand side again, then we can like create an infinite tree. Okay, so an evaluation strategy, so a sequence of all the attributes that we could possibly evaluate, this evaluation strategy can only exist for any abstract syntax tree if the dependencies between the attributes are acyclic, so if there's never a circle between the attributes. And this is what we should check first before we define an equation system. Or rather, we define an equation system, then we should check that no matter what the syntax tree looks like, our equation system will not specify, the dependencies do not form a circle, because otherwise we cannot evaluate it. So that's what we want to check. So we consider the productions of our grammar. So here we have six productions, and we already have seen a dependency, how to write down a dependency graph, D1, D2, D3, and so forth, for each production, the local dependency graph. So now what we do is we create another graph, directed graph, DI prime. So remember, this was DI. For each grammar rule, we had a DI. And now we compute a DI prime for each production I. And this DI prime contains all the local dependencies and the dependencies we have to consider from all the child nodes. And I'll come to that in a second. So as before, as with the unprimed Ds, the vertices of these graphs di prime are the left hand side attributes, so the attributes with a zero index, so the attributes of the left hand side of the production. Those are the nodes in my tree, and as before, we have edges between these nodes. So now I'm only talking about the zero index attributes, so the attributes at the root. So we have an edge from one of these root attributes to another root attributes if the left, AI to AJ, if AI must be evaluated first, so that we can, if we want to compute AJ. So if we have a production and it's DI, production I, and its DI prime graph has an edge between AI 0 and AJ 0, then we know we first have to provide the attribute AI before we can run the evaluation to give us AJ. So that's first we have to provide all the things that, like if we want to know AJ, we first have to provide all the values whose information flows into AJ. Okay, so how do we compute this DI prime graphs? For productions that only contain terminals, so the leaves, we simply set the DI prime graphs to DI. Because there are no children, we automatically have a graph that only relates the attributes at the root. So this is a perfectly valid DI prime graph. Okay, so for the edge information, for other productions that have non-terminals on the right-hand side, we use the current edges from that we've computed for non-terminals and compute a new set of dependencies that we add. So I'll do that on the next slide. And eventually this process will stabilize in the sense that we cannot add any new edges. And then these DI prime graphs denote all the dependencies of all possible trees we can possibly derive in our grammar. That's the idea. So eventually, we'll have a graph for each production that says you have to evaluate, in order, if you want to have the value of this attribute AJ0, you have to provide AI0 and maybe others, all the ones that have edges to AJ0, before you can run the evaluation on this node. So per production. Okay, so the number of edges in each graph is finite. We have one of these graphs for each production in the grammar, so eventually we'll have this process will terminate. And the clue, the key, sits in how do we compute this graph for the productions that have non-terminals on the right-hand side. Okay. This is as follows. So we say we construct a new graph, DI prime, with certain graphs, G1, GN, substituted for the children. So suppose that I is a grammar rule where some sort of non-terminal goes to a right-hand side where we have we can have some before and after, but in total we have N non-terminal symbols on the right-hand side. Then we use a graph G1 to denote the dependencies of the non-terminal N1 on the right-hand side, and so on, graph GN for the dependencies of the non-terminal NN on the right-hand side. And then we compute new dependencies on the root attributes, the zero index attributes. Okay, so let this this term denote a graph that we obtain from the current graph DI prime by adding an edge between the root attributes if there is a path from AI to AJ through this dependency graph, the local dependency graph where we've substituted these graphs for each of the child nodes. And if we see a cycle in this graph while we follow this, or in general, if we see a cycle, we abort. Okay, this requires an example. So let's look at the production where E goes to E dot .e, which has at least a semi-interesting dependency graph. So this is DI. This is the dependency graph that contains all the local dependencies. And the current dependency graph between the root nodes, between the root attributes, so the zero index attributes, is empty, let's say. Because like if we just look at this, there's no direct edges, so we start with the empty set. Now, suppose our graphs, we have three graphs, one for each leaf, and we don't have a graph for G2, so G2 is empty. And so for G1 and G3, we put in the following graphs. This is an example. These graphs don't necessarily come up from the rest of the grammar. But let's just assume, for the sake of an example, that other terminals, other dependencies, raise these two graphs. So we put this graph in here. This is G1. We put it in here. And we put this graph in here. And then we check whether there are dependencies between these three attributes. So can anybody tell me what the outcome is? If I put this graph in here, and if I put this graph into this position here. So let's look at this E here. All the edges from this E are outgoing. And this graph also has an outgoing edge. So if I add this graph in here, it's unlikely that I'll have a path that connects any of these root attributes. So this graph doesn't do much. What about this other graph? If I plug this graph in over this these nodes and at the edges, will I get new dependencies between the root attributes?
Yes, because now the empty attribute of node 3 now depends on the next of the root attribute, and this then depends on then the empty attribute of
okay.
the root also depends
yeah.
on the next.
You are right. Let's try to trace the path just to make it clear. Can you tell me the attribute names in terms of like N0?
Yeah, okay. So the next 0
yeah.
goes over the next of 2.
There's an N2, yeah. Which is this
of
one.
2 and then up to the empty of 0,
ooh.
Which then
yes.
makes the root next the root empty depend on the root next.
Yeah. So basically we look for a path through the graph and then we act at the edge directly between the root attributes. So the result is that we get a single edge from N to E on the root attributes. So looking at this the current set of root node interdependencies, if we add these graphs for the children, then we get this new dependency. What happens if I compute this thing? If I switch G1 and G3 around, so I put this graph over here and this graph over here, which dependencies do I get? Somebody else? Yeah. So it's exactly the same. So the only thing I can do is I can go from this N0 to N1. And putting this graph in, I can go to the path to E1, and from E1, oops, here's E1, I can go back to this E. Ooh, and actually, I can also go to this F. So what I can add is also a dependency between N and F, okay? So switching the graphs around gives me an extra edge. So this you could call this projection onto the root nodes, because you just take a graph and you reduce it to a graph on the nodes at the new nodes at the root. Okay. Now the whole process that I just mentioned in the previous slide of repeatedly doing this looks as follows. So we track this DI graph for each production, the D primed graph for each production. So we have these productions, six productions. We have six graphs over the root nodes. And what we do is we compute an updated set of dependencies by plugging in the current dependency graphs that we already have in each of the productions. So for instance, in order to compute more edges between the root dependencies, root attributes of S, we take the current D1 graph. Initially these are all empty except for the leaves. So let's start with leaves. So this is the only production that only has terminals on the right-hand side. So here we can read off the dependencies between the root attributes, namely here at E, immediately. And if you've seen on a couple of slides back, because the empty attribute is just like depends on the value of X here, and first as well, and the next attribute is not even touched, there are no dependencies. We can just compute these attributes. So the graph here is empty. There's no edges, no dependencies. Okay, so let's look now at the first production. We can get a more accurate set of dependencies by putting in G1 into the only child of D1, which is E. And G1 comes from all the graphs D2 to D2 prime up to D6 prime, because these are the graphs that define E's. Okay, so because here we have an E, we need to plug in all the graphs that can possibly define dependencies for E's. Okay, similarly, let's look at production 3, so that we can update the D3 prime graph, which currently has no edges, by plugging in G1, G2, G3, and G1. G2 is the OR, so that's the empty graph, so we don't care about that. But G1 and G3 can also come from the set D2 to D6. And note, the complexity here is that for G1, I have five choices, and for G3, I have five choices. So just in order to evaluate, to update D3 prime with all current evaluations of current valuations of E, I need 25 combinations. Okay? Same for D4, D5. So D5 and D6, there we only have one E, so it's a little bit simpler. It's only five combinations. So we do this round robin, and eventually we'll stabilize. And in fact, can anybody guess how many dependencies we get? I think this, given the complexity, it's quite... Sorry? The number of edges we get, the dependencies here. So interestingly enough, in this case, we don't get any dependencies because this doesn't give us an evaluation order. It just says if I want to compute a certain attribute, I need to supply a certain other attribute. Okay, let's first look at the complexity. So if we have n attributes, then how many edges can we possibly have? We can have one edge between each pair of attributes. So that's O of n squared. So in the worst case, in each of these iterations, we only add one edge to the DIs. And as I've just explained, like if you put in all combinations, it's a lot of combinations you have to consider. And there's it's actually been shown this is in the order of 2 of n, where n is the number of productions. So it's exponential. This check whether there's a circularity. So what this test does, it doesn't give you an evaluation order. It just says it gives you necessary dependencies on the non-terminals. And if there is a cycle somewhere, then the grammar might give a syntax tree that has a cyclic dependencies between the attributes. If this test gives you no cycle, then you know you can evaluate the grammar. So it's only an approximation to this, to the truth, in the sense that your dependencies are over-approximated. Sometimes, like if you remember the conditional expressions, if the conditional expressions, like when empty is true, you have to add this set as well. Well, these conditional expressions are interpreted as if all the attributes are always evaluated. So at least this gives us a sufficient condition that when the test says there's no circularity, there really is no circularity. So here's a test. Well, here's a little grammar which has a circularity, this has also no circularity, but it's non-trivial. So this is the grammar. S goes to some non-terminal L, and we have attributes H and J, and then L goes to A or L goes to B. So how do we evaluate this? So we have two rules that have only terminals on the right-hand side. And for these, we just look at the graphs of the dependencies. So here we have a dependency for the second rule from K to J, and here from I to H. So what we do is we add an edge from K to J, and we add an edge from I to H. All right. And now we compute D1 prime of graph G1, and graph G1 is one of these two graphs, because these are the possible possible productions for L. So if we put in the first graph, if we put in D2, do we get a cycle, or do we get a dependency between H and J? We'll put this graph in here. Do we get a dependency somewhere? Yes. How? Okay, so there's two things. First of all the arcs point to the root attributes, so we'll never be able to actually get a cycle up here. However, what we could have is we could have a cycle in here inside the local dependency graph, and then we need to abort as well, because then we cannot even compute the local attributes. Okay, but if we put this graph in here, all we get is a dependency graph that goes from here via this edge down here to J and then to I. So we have an edge here. Okay, and then the second possibility, if we clear this, then we put in this graph, what we get is a dependency chain from here to I, down here to H, so to H, and then from H to K. So we have a dependency from J to K. But we cannot have both subgraphs at the same time. So either we have the second production for this L, or we have the third production for this L. But no matter which one we have, there's no cycle. We can't have them both at the same time. So we only can have one, so there's no cycle. So this grammar has no cycle according to this test. Are there any questions? Okay, so there's no cycles while evaluating these di primes, and in particular, there's not even a single edge between H and J at the root. Okay, so what I've shown you is a strategy to check whether there's a cycle in any of the produced possible trees that the context-free grammar can produce, but as I said, it's also exponential, so the question is there maybe a cheaper version that's also easier to implement rather than doing all these computations, at least. So yes, there is, and it's called strongly acyclic dependency graphs. And so with larger grammars, this previous algorithm could be too expensive because it's exponential. So we do an approximation, a sufficient condition, so that the attribute equation system is acyclic. So what do we do? Well, we don't compute an attribute graph for each production, but we just compute an attribute graph for each non-terminal. So one graph for a non-terminal. So for each production where the non-terminal goes to sum t1 to tn, where the ti's are terminals, as before, any rule that only has terminals, we just collect all the dependency graphs, the local dependency graphs, and this is our d prime. And then we again compute d prime with some subgraphs, but this time not for each production I, but just for the non-terminal n. So if n is a rule that goes to S1 to Sn, where S are terminals or non-terminals, we put in the graphs of these. So the ith graph are the root attributes of this corresponding terminal or non-terminal. So we put in the graph as before, but this is per non-terminal. Then we evaluate, as before, each rule until none of the graphs change. And if we then detect a cycle in any of these computation, we say it could have a cycle. But it's an approximation, so. So an example again. Now, we have this. I have the same pathologic grammar. S goes to L, L goes to A or B. These are the local dependency graphs, as before. So now we look at all the productions that only have terminals on the right-hand side, which are this and this production. And then we take the local dependency graph and we conjoin the edges. So now we don't have a graph dn for each rule, we just have one for each non-terminal. So for the L non-terminal, we just join the edges, so we have an edge from I to H0 from this production, and we have an edge from K to J for the production L goes to A. So this is the first step, and then we take this graph and put it in to the local dependencies here and look whether there's some sort of cycle in here. So if we do that, what happens if I do that? If I put in this graph in here, if I put this graph that I've generated by looking at all the rules that lead to terminals, if I put this graph in here, okay, well, I'll put in the edges, and then could you explain the cycle? By using the index notation, so this is an exercise for the index notation. Oh! Well, this is all index 1, really, because it's the first child. So it's h of 1, I'm afraid. Okay, so h of 1 goes to... I know this is naff, it's really silly. So h of 0 goes to...
h of 0?
Yeah. Oh, h of 1.
Oh, h of 1
yeah.
Goes to k.
K of 1, yeah.
J1, I1.
Yeah, and back to h1. So we have a cycle. So what we try to compute the ds prime graph, and while doing that, we found a cycle. Then we tell the user, oh, this grammar might have a cycle. So the difference to the previous algorithm is it's much faster, it's much easier to compute, but we get an approximate result that's conservative, because we now combine all the graphs onto the non-terminals rather than on a production base. And then this algorithm is very efficient, but it might give us the message it's cyclic, when it is actually not the case. So the difference between strong acyclicity and being acyclic is that this grammar actually is acyclic. So the normal, so these are the only two trees that can be generated in their attribute system or their attribute dependencies. And since all the trees that this grammar can generate are acyclic, obviously the attribute system can be evaluated. However, this strong acyclicity test says false. This gram is not strongly acyclic, because if you plug in these the dependencies from each non-terminal as a graph, and then compute the dependencies, you'll find that there's a cycle here. So this gram is an example which is not acyclic, although it's cycle. Not strongly acyclic, although it is actually acyclic. So these are two algorithms for testing whether an attribute system is cyclic or not, and one is an approximation of the other. Okay, are there any questions? Maybe this needs like a look at. I think it's, yeah, it's a lot of definitions and notations. I hope it gets clearer with the exercises. So the test is great, but what do we do with that? So obviously we don't get an evaluation strategy, because it doesn't tell us that we have to put in next in order to compute first and empty, because that's what the regular expression require. We need to put in next so that we can compute first and empty. So this acyclicity test just tells us whether there's a cycle. It doesn't tell us how to evaluate the syntax tree. So there's several strategies. First one is the best one, because it doesn't concern us, and except when we implement a compiler. We could have the user, that is the compiler writer, define the evaluation order. And in most compilers, this is probably done, because they don't really care about the theory of attribute grammars. They just write it, and then they define it on the fly. But we could also try to be more principled and automatically generate some sort of visiting strategy based on the dependencies. So if we just look at the local attributes, we could it's quite easy to say how to evaluate stuff, because if we look at the local dependencies, like this is the local dependency graph for E goes to E star. Then if we know that we require S, where's S coming from? I think this is N, sorry. If we require next one, so this one, then we need to compute F1, which is this one, and F1 we need to now know that F1 depends on some attribute in the child, so that we need to descend in order to compute that. So while it's easy to locally say what to evaluate, we still need to know where this attribute comes from, and that's not necessarily clear. But locally it's clear once we know that everything else is there. So what we could aim for is we could say, oh, we want to compute things in parses. So pars is a traversal of the abstract syntax tree, usually a complete traversal, and then we want to say, well, let's ask how many can we separate the evaluation into several parses. So in this case we can. So if the dependencies are not cyclic, which they should never be, then we could compute a dependency graph between the attributes by overlaying all the graphs. And if it happens that there is what remains, so we take all the DN primes, the overlays for each non-terminal symbol, and we propagate that. We overlay all those graphs, these different graphs talking about different non-terminals, and we get a graph amongst all the attributes in our equation system. If that has a cycle, we're out of luck. But if it doesn't have a cycle, it tells us which attributes. We can then follow these edges, and we know that for each attribute, we can just pass through the tree, compute the attribute according to this ordering, and then we can compute the next one. So, for instance, if we overlay all the dependencies, all the edges between the first, the empty, and the next attribute, we see that the information in the empty attribute flows into the first information, and that next only depends on first and on next values. So what we can do is we can do three passes, one for E, one for F, and one for N, and we're sure that whenever we evaluate F and we've visited the whole tree for E first, then we know it's there and there's all the dependencies are fulfilled. But this doesn't always work, because if we overlay all the dependencies between attributes, we might get a cycle. But if it works, then this is the way to go. Yeah, I don't know why there is a G. Probably because G comes after F, so there should be N. So, page 20.
Thank you.
Okay, so alternative, third alternative, we consider a fixed strategy that only allows an attribute system that can be evaluated using this strategy. And that's also very popular. I'm coming to that. Okay, so I've said, like, there's automatic strategies and there's fixed strategies and there's user-defined strategies. Let's quickly look at the automatic strategies again that I've already mentioned briefly. So we could have, suppose we have an acyclic attribute system. Then we could just ad hoc determine what to evaluate next. And this is called demand-driven evaluation, especially interesting if we're only interested in a few attributes of the tree. So we start with the attribute, like we try to evaluate the attribute that we want to compute, and then we see that actually it depends on some other attribute that is so far not evaluated. And then we simply recursively evaluate that attribute, and that will move us along the tree, maybe up, down, anywhere. So we visit the nodes of the syntax tree on demand, so that's where the name comes from, it's demand-driven evaluation. This is might be a bit complex if you have an abstract syntax tree and you see, oh, I need the attribute from the parent, we always need to have some sort of back pointer from this node to the parent or from the child to the parent, but it's doable. And the evaluation passes, as I've said on the last slide, if we have all the dependencies, for instance, between the different attributes, we still might be interested in minimizing the number of visits to each node. So we don't want, for 20 attributes, we don't want to run through the whole syntax tree 20 times. We want to reduce that. So we want to organize the evaluation of the tree in passes, in the sense that we want to evaluate several attributes at the same time. So we could try to pre-compute a strategy that visits certain nodes and evaluates attributes. So you need a strategy that says first visit this child, then visit this child, and afterwards you can use the local dependencies to evaluate the attributes within the node. Okay, so I'm not going to talk much about the possibilities of devising these evaluation passes but I would quickly talk about demand-driven analysis and give an example, because that's actually implementable, easy to implement, and that's why I want to show it. So let's reconsider the same regular expression A or B star, then A, then A or B. And suppose we want to compute the next attribute, which is here. Oh, at all these leaves. So here, this next, this next, this next. So we have the dependencies that the next. So if we ask for this. Yeah, so if we want to evaluate this next attribute, we'll just move up the parent until we get the empty set. Then we evaluate this next attribute and we move up and we see the values already there and we can compute it. And now we want to have this attribute next. And what happens is that the next value of this attribute, of this A here, depends on the E and the F, and there in turn rely on this, depend on this, and on this, I think. Yeah, so That means we have to compute empty and first of this node here. So this is one attribute set, and of this node as well. Well, we don't need to compute empty and first or next from the other branch. And we don't need to compute first from this node or first from this node. So this can save us. The demand-driven evaluation can save us from evaluating parts of the syntax tree. And it's nice to implement. So the nice thing is that it only requires attributes that are actually going to be evaluated. The evaluation sequence, since it's dynamic, depends on the actual syntax tree. And the algorithm must track which attributes it has already evaluated. Say if you use Java or C, you could just, like, if all attributes are pointers, you could initialize them with null. If they're null, you know they're not evaluated yet, and then you kickstart the evaluation of whatever they depend on. Once you know the value, set it to the value, and then it's there. Then the attribute is there. Also, the algorithm may visit nodes more often than if you partition the attributes in passes and do a traversal in passes. You have to have this back pointer to the parent, and the algorithm is not local, so the evaluation strategy is not fixed for each node, but it's always doing anything depending on what you're evaluating. So it sounds actually quite tempting in principle. It might be quite difficult to debug because it's very dynamic, because it all depends on the abstract syntax tree. And actually, normally you want all attributes everywhere, so it's not really a benefit to be able to compute a few attributes. Okay, so we could evaluate in passes, and there are certain standard traversals, which is why I'm talking about this, because I think in the exercises, if we do anything, we should probably do the demand-driven thing, because that's interesting. Okay, so if we do evaluation in passes, we want to traverse the syntax tree several times, or as few times as possible, and each time we evaluate all the equations of this form, whenever we know that the attributes that it depends on, that this equation depends on, if they're known. So each time we want to compute some new attributes. So if we have a strongly acyclic attribute system, then we know that the dependencies for each non-terminal are not cyclic, which means that the local dependencies of the ith production together with these dependency graph define a sequence in which the attributes can be evaluated. Now the question is whether we can combine the evaluation of several attributes so that we don't visit so we don't have n passes for n attributes. Is nice, so we would like to evaluate several attributes at the same time, but I'm not going to say how to do that because, well, it's a bit off topic. But the point is that because there is no cyclic dependencies, and because we have local dependency graph and the global dependency graph, that is for each non-terminal, has no cycle, there's always one attribute that we can evaluate in each pass. So in worst case, if we do this demand-driven approach where we explicitly say whether an attribute has been evaluated or not, we could just do a fixed evaluation. And in each pass, we just evaluate as much as we can until we have evaluated all attributes. So we need at most n passes if we evaluate n attributes. So we kind of have a traversal strategy to evaluate at least one attribute. And the question is whether we can just statically determine that we can first compute first and empty. And then the second pass, next, is a different problem. That's kind of an optimization problem that I'm not going to talk about. Now, with this approach, if we're just looking at asking, well, given this input, attributes, these inherited input attributes at the root. Give me an evaluation strategy with the local dependencies that evaluates all other attributes possible. Then, depending on these already evaluated root attributes, I might have different set of attributes that I can evaluate it. So in worst case, if I just like enumerate all those evaluation possibilities, then for k attributes and the root, I might have 2k to the minus 1 different evaluation functions in each for each non-terminal or for each production. So that's not very attractive. So you want to analyze, to optimize that. I'm not going to tell you how. So we've seen that empty and first can be computed together and next can be computed in a separate path with this approximation of overlaying all the dependencies, and this will do. So, because so this is another example, and I think I'll stop here. So next week I'll just, so I've talked a lot about passes and how to determine an evaluation strategy. The reason why I'm not want to go to details there is I'm going to talk about next week about L-attributed attribute systems, and there the evaluation strategy is fixed and you try to build your attribute system so that this evaluation strategy fits, and that's usually how you design your attribute systems. So this is the outlook for next time and the reason why I'm not dwelling on these passes. Okay. Right, okay. That's it for today. Are there any questions? Okay, then I'll... Oh yeah, I have to one announcement. The exercise, Thursday's bank holiday, unfortunately, which gives our whole schedule a new twist. So you're going to have a session with Kalmar this today, right now. If all the Thursday people are invited to come along, if you can't come along today, all the Thursday people, if they can't come along today, you can see him personally, write an email, but we can't provide an alternative date for the Thursday lesson because it's just too much organizational hazard for those people who then afterwards cannot show up anyway. So please come today if you can, or see him personally or write him an email. Okay, thank you.